from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and by support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today, our show has an international flavor.
I'll get a tour of the IMA's Sacred Spain exhibit.
I'll learn about the Italian Reggio Emilia Art Education Program.
And I'll find out about some haunted houses in Indiana. And there's a calendar of events we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Today, when we hear Spain, we think of a single country, but 17th century Spain was a worldwide empire, influencing and beset by political, social, and religious change. The first art exhibition to examine the religious visual culture of the 17th century Spanish Empire has just opened at the Indianapolis Museum of Art. Rhonda Castle, senior curator of painting and sculpture before 1800, started dreaming of creating this tour de force of 70 artworks when she lived in Spain many years ago. And she made time during the exhibit's installation to come in to share some insights with Sharon Gamble.
Well, first of all, I want to ask, how long have you been living with this exhibition behind the scenes? It's new news to all of us in the city, in the state, in the world, but I know that you've been behind the scenes living and breathing these works for some number of years.
You know, I'm almost embarrassed to admit that how long I've been working on this project. I formally proposed this exhibition in August of 1999.
Oh, my gosh.
And you know, obviously, I've done plenty of things in the meantime,
sure,
but
sure.
The exhibition has actually been in the oven for a long time, and it's a fairly complex exhibition, and I think it's benefited from...
A long gestation.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
What sparked your desire to put this exhibition together in the first place? Was there a particular work or a succession of experiences you had with certain pieces that you... There was an aha moment?
Well, I'm a specialist in Spanish art and was fortunate enough to live in Spain for almost 3 years while I worked on my dissertation.
Ooh.
And... I think it was the experience of seeing works of art, images, being used that caused me to want to do this exhibition. In other words, to see a sculpture of museum quality paraded through the streets during Holy Week and to watch how... individuals interacted with it. That's the sort of experience that isn't easy to transfer to an art museum where we're accustomed to seeing static objects.
Sure. Did you have a little
in vitrines and hanging on walls?
Right. Did you have a little tinge of, oh, don't drop that? Or
A little bit, but it is surprising, you know, to see 15th century tapestries hung from balconies in the streets and you know, some of the greatest masterpieces of Spanish sculpture being carried in the rain.
Wow. That's a whole different mindset.
One realizes very quickly that these are objects that are not just meant to be seen, but manipulated.
I like the three sort of touchstone words that are used to describe this exhibition. These are 70 works meant to be useful, truthful, and moving. The useful is especially mm-hmm. surprising
mm-hmm.
and kind of dovetails with what you just said. This is art that was not purely decorative by any stretch of the imagination.
Sure, and not just meant for aesthetic contemplation.
And not just meant for the wealthy either, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
In I read recently that the Spanish Empire was the first one of which it was said the sun never sets on. We always think of the British Empire, but it was actually the Spanish Empire. The 17th century was a time of great change within the Spanish Empire. A lot of unsettling things happening, plagues that killed 500,000 people, political leaders who might not have been as strong as desired, religious changes. Can you talk in broad strokes about that context and the works in this exhibition?
Sure. One of the things I think people are surprised to know or to learn is not just that the Spanish Empire literally encircled the globe in the 17th century, from Mexico to Peru to the Philippine Islands, literally encircled the globe, but also that empire was so durable. The Spanish viceroyalty of New Spain to present-day Mexico lasted for 300 years.
It's quite an accomplishment.
So it wasn't a brief setting of the sun over the Spanish Empire. And as a result, a very large percentage of the world's population speaks Spanish. And it's one of the things that inspired us for the first time ever at the Art Museum to have bilingual labels and wall texts and interpretive materials.
A huge undertaking
a
in
huge
and of itself.
Huge.
Congratulations.
It's very, very difficult.
As we're having this conversation, the exhibition has not opened yet, so congratulations in advance, I should say. So was most of this, or maybe I should start a different way, what percentage of this Spanish Empire was Catholic at the time of most of the objects of this exhibition?
Well, they were either Catholic or in the process of becoming Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
Much of this art had a role in the evangelization of the Americas. The indigenous populations obviously weren't Spanish speaking, so images that narrated Christian history were really very, very important. And that was maybe one of the most important uses of images in the 17th century, in the New World anyway, just simply to teach.
So there are some of the objects, paintings, sculptures, and so forth, have a narrative quality, an educational quality. Some of them are very personal and meant to be used in a fairly private setting.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to hear about some of those pieces, maybe favorites of yours.
You know, the last section of the exhibition, there's six sections in the exhibition. The last one is called Living with Images. And it was very common for people to have religious images in their homes and to use those images as aids in their private devotions. And some of the most interesting pieces in this part of the exhibition include a couple of holy dolls. They're life-size images of the infant Christ. And most of these would have been owned by women.
Mm-hmm.
And they dressed them, and they used them in a kind of role playing almost that involved manipulating these dolls and adoring them and praying to them and dressing them.
Would they have used them within the family to instruct children as well about religion?
Quite possibly. They were displayed on altars, but they were also manipulated in various ways.
Huh. Would these be pieces that would then be passed down within a family?
Yes. Actually, that's really an important point to make. Thanks for bringing that up. The sort of object that would have been given to women as trousseau,
mm-hmm.
Or as part of their dowries, and very often passed on from mother to daughter, from one woman to another, and that adds to this very personal, intimate quality.
Absolutely.
They were very often named them, giving them names like el primogénito, the firstborn, or things like that.
Wow.
We discovered when we unpacked one of the sculptures coming from a private collection in Madrid. It's a sculpture of the Virgin Mary adoring a life-size figure of the infant Christ. And when we took it out of the crate, we realized that the infant was removable.
Oh.
And it probably was used in nativity scenes and similar kinds of devotion, separate from the sculpture group that it will be displayed with in the exhibition.
What a fascinating window into everyday life.
Yeah.
And sort of at the other end of the spectrum, we have the Crown of the Andes with 447 emeralds. What is the story of the Crown of the Andes?
Well, it's a very long story, in fact. The Crown of the Andes, as you probably know, was created to adorn the head of a sculpture of the Virgin Mary that was and is actually venerated in the Cathedral of Popayan in present-day Colombia. It's very likely that the emeralds that decorate the crown were gifts from individual worshippers in honor of the Virgin, and simply added to the crown over the course of time.
Wow. Of the objects that you, and I know you've been in the process of unpacking and installing the exhibition as we're having our conversation, what are some of the other surprises? Obviously, you've seen all these objects before, but when you actually get to have them here and live with them with a little more leisure, what are some of the other lessons you've learned that surprised you?
It's very interesting for me to watch the reaction of colleagues at the museum who are seeing the objects for the first time. They're familiar to me, and I've always imagined and hoped that people would react as strongly to them as I do. And in fact, that's been the case as the things come out of the crate. There's a kind of collective gasp. A couple of days ago, we uncrated a life-size processional figure of a recumbent Christ, very, very, very lifelike. Mm. It's a beautiful work that's to this day carried in processions during Holy Week in the town of Navalcarnero, which isn't too far from Madrid. Never been seen outside of Navalcarnero. And when the work was uncrated, the crew were on their knees to pull it out of the crate. And I wish I'd had a camera at the time, because there they were, de rodillas, on their knees, watching the thing come out of the crate. And it's just stunning. It's exactly life size for a reason. One is meant to interact with it, and it's very important that it's of human scale. No bigger, no smaller, exactly our size.
That's one of the most interesting aspects of the exhibition to me, is that lots of times religious artworks are meant, and architecture I would include, are meant to make us feel small.
Mm-hmm.
And not in a negative way, but make us feel the grandeur of the deity. And there's a real sense of accessibility and identification here, all the way from taking the family Christ child doll and handing it, putting it up on the altar to this life-size recumbent Christ. Mm-hmm. There's a real sense of What?
Humanity.
Humanity. That's it.
It's humanity. It has to do with the paradox of the incarnation, that divinity is incarnate in human form. It's quite possible to represent divinity by means of symbols like a crucifix or a fish or a lamb even, but to represent the incarnation of divinity in human form is quite a different matter.
Sharon Gamble with Rhonda Castle, the Indianapolis Museum of Art's senior curator of painting and sculpture before 1800, and the mastermind behind the groundbreaking Sacred Spain, Art and Belief in the Spanish World. You can see the stunning exhibit through January 3rd of next year. And be sure to visit imamuseum.org to find background videos, blogs, and much, much more. Again, imamuseum.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Reggio Emilia is a village in northern Italy that is known for having what are considered the best preschools in the world. Reggio Emilia is also now used to describe a specific type of early childhood education that encourages discovery of the world through the arts. Currently at the Indiana State House, there is an exhibit about the Reggio Emilia approach to education, and Travis DiNicola spoke with Butler's Dean of the College of Education, Dr. Ina Goodrich Shelley, about Reggio Emilia.
Congratulations on a fantastic collaborative and the exhibit that's connected with it, which we're going to talk about very soon. But before we get to talking about this great exhibit about Reggio Emilia at the Indiana State House, give me a little background on what this whole collaborative is that Butler's involved with so many other educators and specifically art educators in really bringing a Reggio Emilia approach to Indianapolis. Maybe part of that can include, give us a brief background about what Reggio Emilia is, and then we'll talk about more in depth later.
Oh, happy to do so. Reggio Emilia is a city in the northern province of Italy, and they have been at this important work for over 50 years. And it began shortly after World War II. Of course, their country had been devastated by war, and the first thing that this particular city decided to do was build a school for their young children, believing that out of all the devastation, good must come. And their work began with the importance of believing that all children have competency and capabilities that just need to be tapped and potential. Mm-hmm. And that children have 100 ways of knowing and 100 ways of learning. So, of course, with their culture, the importance of the arts, they began looking at programs or developing their programs based upon looking at the environment, how space impacts learning, and then how all the different languages of art can be used for children to make sense of their world.
And we're talking about very young children here. I mean,
very
really
young children.
Like 2 to 5 years old for the most part.
Well, in Reggio Emilia, they actually have infants, infants through 6-year-olds.
Well, okay.
Yeah. And heavy emphasis on the tactile, physical, sensory environment, even beginning with the infants. And it's been something I've been studying for quite some time because of the importance of knowing that so much learning happens in the early years. But I think in our country, we often neglect the power of the arts
in the learning process.
Let me ask you about that, because there's certainly no doubt that an infant is exploring mm-hmm. the world and, mm-hmm. and learning just massive amounts of things about the world on a daily basis, because mm-hmm. Everything's so new. But when you hear the idea of, you know, teaching art to infants or, mm-hmm. you know, even, you know, 2 or 3 year olds, I mean, how... We're not talking about art appreciation necessarily. Right. We're not taking these kids to a museum. We're not teaching them how to sketch a figure. How does this work? I mean, how do the arts get incorporated into that?
Well, one is believing that children should be surrounded by beauty and harmony, of course, which are the arts, and bringing in beautiful materials, beautiful pieces of artwork. But also giving children materials that they can explore and manipulate with. Now, I can tell you, having had the good fortune of studying several times in Reggio Emilia, mm-hmm. they teach the children beginning at age 3 how to use the materials. Mm-hmm. So I've been fascinated in watching what they call an atelierista or a studio art teacher actually teach 3-year-olds how do you work with the medium of clay mm-hmm. so that you can actually make the representation that you want. Another way they bring this in is helping children focus on the detail. And so they teach them observational drawings. And so looking at a sunflower, for example, and looking at it through a magnifying glass and then starting to sketch, parts of the sunflower and what does it feel like? And then giving them high quality materials to use to make those representations. And people, when they first see artwork done by children in Reggio Emilia, they're struck by, that could not have been done by a young child. There's mm-hmm. there's much, much too much sophistication in that. Again, not realizing that young children are very capable of doing that. But I think it's that being able to focus on detail and appreciation and really helping children find the way to do that. And it's incredible what they're able to represent in their knowing and understanding.
It really does challenge our expectations of what children are capable for, but also challenge our conception of what art education is and how that
Absolutely.
Takes place.
Absolutely. I affectionately refer to a lot of what I see in programs called refrigerator art, and it's something that's done very quickly by children, and they put it in their cubbies.
You mean like
and
hand turkeys.
Yes, hand turkeys and awful things like that, and they take them, they put them in their cubbies and put them in their backpacks all scrunched up, take them home, and it gets put on the refrigerator, and it doesn't have a lot of meaning. And when you work with the approach from Reggio Emilia, it's the belief that you look and you look again and you go back and you study it again, and that it takes many drafts and perseverance mm-hmm. and patience. And I think those are important skills for children to have, but I think they're I've seen the evidence, they're able to do that. And it's teaching them a lot about not only the art forms, but the ability to stick with something and produce something that's important, not just kind of do something halfway and say, oh, that's good, when it's
sure.
really not.
You know, I think that when I first heard about Reggio Emilia maybe, a dozen years ago mm-hmm. or so, I was sort of under the wrong impression that it was really all just about the process of discovery. And, of mm-hmm. course, mm-hmm. discovery and exploration is a huge part of it. But as you were just saying, mm-hmm. the process of returning to the work of refining it, of going back to it, mm-hmm. it does also put a lot of value on the product itself, of what's created mm-hmm. in the end.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I totally agree. Mm-hmm. And again, it goes back to what they have taught us about the image of the child, mm-hmm. believing that children are able to do this if we give them the time, the space, the support, and the materials to do so.
Let me ask you briefly about the collaborative. Who are some of the schools and educators involved with it?
Oh, they're wonderful schools. It's the Warren Early Childhood Center in Warren Township, St. Mary's Child Center, which there are 2 locations, and the Early Learning Centers of Lawrence Township and the College of Education at Butler University.
Excellent. And you're also doing some work with Young Audiences of Indiana, correct?
Yes, we are. Yes, we are. Young Audiences was actually very helpful to us in helping put together the the whole process of getting the exhibit here, but also the conference that we just held this weekend. They were very helpful.
Now tell me about the exhibit at the State House, because there are many people, I'm sure, who've been walking around the State House the past month or so and going, you know, what are all these huge panels of Italian kids, you know, making great artwork? What's this all about?
Well, that's great. The exhibit is here until December 18th.
Mm-hmm.
And the exhibit was designed by the educators from Reggio Emilia. And it's what we call pedagogical documentation, or making learning visible is how we like to explain it. And it is their gift to North America. And it's their attempt to show the process of their philosophy and what the children are actually doing. So you can actually get a sense from visiting the exhibit of what Reggio Emilia is about and what the impact and importance to young children. To get the exhibit to Indianapolis was quite a victory, truthfully. This is the new exhibit. There was a prior exhibit that traveled for 10 years, but this is the new one. It premiered in Boulder in June of 2008. Cities have to bid for it, mm-hmm. and if you are awarded the exhibit, it is a nod from the North American Reggio Emilia Alliance, as well as Reggio Children, which is in Italy. It's a nod that the work you are doing is significant, and they believe that you have more mm-hmm. potential in your community to share this work. So,
well, congratulations.
Thank you. It's quite a victory for the collaborative to have this.
It's really great. And it's such an enormous exhibit. I don't know how many panels are a part of it.
It's 5,000 square feet.
Wow. And it takes really sort of over the State House, over three floors. And each panel deals with sort of a different aspect of Reggio Emilia, whether it's the notion of giving gifts, which is a big part of the education process. There's a wonderful piece about a stairway that kids use to make sound out of and sort of giving gifts back to. There's also pieces about creating work around a tree outside. There's a lot of work that takes place outside for the students in Reggio Emilia that I was really impressed by as well. I think it's hard to pick out one panel or one section mm-hmm. that's the best. But, you know, I guess I would have to say if someone hasn't seen it, is it a free exhibit? I mean, just walk into the
State
House.
It's a free exhibit.
There's a section that focuses on these enormous sort of almost like totem poles, these large structures. So tell me a bit about that, because I was just amazed by the quality of the artwork that was exhibited.
Well, it's the section on the columns, mm-hmm. and in Reggio Emilia, fairly recently, within about, I think, the last 5 years, they were able to purchase a beautiful building. It used to be a cheese factory, actually. It's about a city block in size, and that has become their international center. And within that building are columns.
Mm-hmm.
And as they began to think about how they would use the space, they had the children from various Reggio schools come and visit and explore the columns and ask, okay, we're going to have visitors from all over the world come. What would you think that visitors might want to see and leave remembering about Reggio Emilia and the purpose of columns?
Mm-hmm.
And what they have done is created their version of what they believe are the most beautiful columns, and kind of their, as you said earlier, their gift, kind of the gift to the visitor to remember the space. So it's really their interpretation of what they think the space should be.
That's an incredible use of materials in creating these columns. I refer to them as totem poles because mm-hmm. there's really a sense that each one has a very specific meaning attached
mm-hmm.
to it.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously using materials that they have available to them, there's a real also a sense of recycling materials that that they find or are donated from other people in the village. Or obviously they're taking over a cheese factory, but I remember one I think used CDs, and another used different materials from a factory that they had been given and were able to reappropriate.
Yes, there's actually a center in Reggio Emilia. It's called the Remita Center, which is an enormous recycling center where all the different businesses and industries give their materials to them, and then they're organized, and teachers just bring literally shopping carts and fill the shopping carts mm-hmm. with any of the recyclable materials. It's very, as we would say, green, if mm-hmm. you will, and they've been doing this for years. And we're hoping to be able to create something like that in the Indianapolis community. We think that would be wonderful for all teachers to be able to have that.
Now, you said the exhibit is here through December.
Yes.
Again, at the State House. audience. What do you think the impact has been for both the partners that you've been working with, as well as for the community, by having this exhibit here? I know that there were actually a group of Italians who came in to visit recently and sort of commented on and held some workshops. How has this impacted the work you've been doing?
Well, I think for the collaborative, it has made us study even deeper. As you try to explain to people who come to your city perhaps for the first time, or even people within Indiana who are not familiar with this, it makes you reflect about your own work and go deeper in being able to articulate it. Of course, the exhibit itself is something that we are studying together, because you can see the exhibit and then you go back and look at it again and you see something else that you missed, or another thought that, you know, at that time just seems appropriate for you, and you think, oh, I didn't think about this, or how did I not see it? In terms of the community, I think it's bringing awareness to another way, another approach to education. When we think about being global citizens, when we think about 21st century skills, I think this offers the possibility of another way of thinking about education. We do have guest books on each floor, and we've been monitoring who's signing the guest book, and it's fascinating to see who's coming through to see the exhibit. Parents, we've had policymakers, business people, a lot of people from within state, but many people from out of state. And so I think it's bringing an awareness to our community that we can transform education, and this is one way to do it.
Travis DiNicola with Butler's Dean of the College of Education, Dr. Ina Goodrich Shelley. The Reggio Emilia exhibit at the State House continues through December 18th. The Indianapolis Reggio Collaborative is composed of a community of educators, and more information can be found at enegene.com. Again, enegene.com. Hey, Travis, I know you live in an old house.
Yes, I do, Sharon.
Is your house haunted?
You know, actually, I think it is.
What sort of things have happened in your house?
Well, when we first moved in, there were a lot of things that kept sort of falling, or a window actually shut on my wife's finger and stuff. But then we made peace with the ghost, and I think everything's been okay since. You live in an old house, too, don't you?
Yeah. I haven't experienced anything yet, but I'm still kind of waiting.
Oh, yeah?
My next-door neighbor hears people playing the cello outside her window, and I swear it's,
it's not me.
It's not me. But, you know, I'll bet there are some things that we can do and our listeners can do on today's calendar that have to do with haunting.
I think so.
It's time for
What'll We Boo?
Do you have a Halloween theme thing to start with?
Of course. Ghost Tales of Indiana at the Benjamin Harrison Home.
I love
Victorian
that.
Ghost Tales. These are a lot of fun, and they're told by a number of different actors in town, and this is going on through this weekend. They have performances both Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night. The performances are scheduled every half hour, beginning at 6 p.m., and actually on Saturday at 3:30 p.m., and they last about an hour or so down the present Benjamin Harrison Home, with different dramatizations of Ghost Tales of Indiana.
Excellent. Hey, does the actor named Jack Haley mean anything to you?
Does he come around every, 80 years or so?
No, not the comment.
Okay.
This sounds like a question from film sociology, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Well, he is best remembered today as the Tin Man from The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, but in 1947, he actually made a delightful haunted house comedy mystery where he played an insurance salesman who comes to an old dark mountaintop house only to find that his client has expired and not from natural causes. And, of course, as these things go, especially in a 1947 film, everyone is a suspect. No one calls the police or leaves the building. Of course, Jane Parker is the lovely second lead. Bela Lugosi has another of his, I don't want to give away what he does. All of this can be experienced on Friday, October 30th, next Friday at 7 at the Irving, the historic Irving Theater in Irvington, 5505
really
East
fun.
Washington Street. Absolutely. And a vintage cartoon as well.
Nice.
Woohoo!
You mentioned a ghost playing a cello. That's not exactly what this is about. But there is a violin and cello duet program that's taking place on Sunday, the Musical Musings Recital Series up at Meridian Music, Munger Hall, and Constantine and Polina Umansky are going to be performing at 7 p.m. And that's at Meridian Music up in Carmel.
Now,
no ghosts.
No ghosts. The next two, I'm still on the film beat here. The next two films are silent films with live musical scores, one from 1922, the other from 1926. And I have seen both of these, and I will tell you, your film education is not complete unless you have seen 1922's Nosferatu.
Oh, yeah.
Sort of the original vampire film, or 1926's Metropolis. Fabulous, fabulous films, and you can see them at the Toby at the Indianapolis Museum of Art. So go check that out. The 29th is Nosferatu at 7. The November 5th is Metropolis, also at 7 at the IMA.
Past couple of weeks, I've mentioned two great dance performances coming up on the Halloween weekend that I just got to get them both in again, Sharon. One is Hancock doing The Casket Girls, which is a modern goth alternative vampire ballet. And then, of course, we've got a little bit more traditional, The Phantom of the Opera with the Indiana Ballet Company. So Casket Girls, Gregory Hancock, taking place at the Pike Performing Arts Center on the 29th and 30th, and Phantom of the Opera, Indiana Ballet Company, down at the Madam Walker on the 30th and 31st.
Excellent. You know, there is absolutely nothing scary about my next item except the scary good talents of Andre Watts. He likes Indianapolis. In fact, he loves Indianapolis because it was in our fair city where he met his wife. But he's also a perennial favorite with Indianapolis audiences, and the American Pianist Association is bringing Andre Watts to town on Sunday the 25th as part of their Grand Encounters series. He's going to be in the Ruth Lilly Performance Hall at University of Indianapolis, and you should call and get your tickets very, very soon.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Hey, here's something that's not scary at all. It's an exhibit of Walter Knoppe's work. You know, normally he's known for his beautiful fabrics and wall coverings and decorative work. It's actually an exhibit of his paintings up at the Evan Laurie Gallery in Carmel that opens on Friday night and runs for the next month. So a great opportunity to see a lot of Walter's other work.
Excellent. Something that is scary that's going on right now and all the way through Halloween night is, of course, Tomb of Doom. Actually, Travis, I think I should have you say
it. Tomb of Doom.
There, it's much better when you do it. Quest for the Lost Mummy, and it is, of course, a takeoff on the King Tut exhibit going on at the Children's Museum right now. It's the 46th annual haunted house at the Children's Museum. So you don't have to be a child to enjoy it, but you can take children with you and check the website for the Children's Museum about special lights on nights if you have little ones who don't want to be quite as scared.
In the Tomb of Doom. Well, we will be back next week with things I'm sure not nearly as scary on
What'll We Boo.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Jeff Bellinger believes that to truly understand a haunted location, you need to get local. Jeff is the editor and compiler for the Encyclopedia of Haunted Places. His job is to find local experts who work to back up each ghostly claim. Hearsay and urban legends aren't enough. Each entry combines the history, the tragedies, and the eyewitness accounts of each haunted locale. Jeff took off his Ghostbuster gear just long enough to speak with Sharon Gamble about the haunted places in Indiana that were considered legitimate enough to make it into the Encyclopedia of Haunted Places.
All right, before we get into the Hoosier haunted places, I want to know how you narrowed in on this strategy or philosophy of having the places be vetted by an expert team. How did that come about?
It came about by being really lazy.
Okay.
My publisher called me years ago and said, hey, we want to do a big directory, international, of haunted places all over the world. And I said, oh, my goodness, that sounds like a lot of work. You know, having worked on haunted places for over a decade now, I know what it takes to really get the story right. And I know being local helps a lot. And so I said, oh, well, you know, there's paranormal research groups all over the planet, thousands and thousands of them. If we reached out to them about the places they know best, boy, that would really be something and would get such a great perspective. So that's how the idea was born. And then, you know, so we're really reaching out to those groups and trusting their research and what they're finding. And we found places that were well-known, not so well-known, infamous, famous, and everything in between.
It probably makes for a better a voice for the narrative as well. Instead of being homogenous, one person is interpreting everything. You've got the local color going on.
Exactly, yeah. Now, and the other part of it, too, is that we were trying to be diverse. First of all, the place, we wanted it to be accessible to the public, so not private residences that you could never visit. Oh. We also wanted it to be diverse and not just have a book full of cemeteries or a book full of battlefields or old creepy museums, things like that. So we wanted to show the diversity of haunted places because, boy, there's next to no rules on what can and can't be haunted.
How did you get started? You certainly have a high profile as someone who is interested in the paranormal, interested in the spirit world. What was your first haunted moment or your first inkling that there might be something from beyond?
Well, I grew up around ghosts. I grew up in an old New England town and had friends that from a young age just said, yeah, my house is haunted. And so we'd have sleepovers in these 250-year-old homes and break out Ouija boards. And what struck me was not so much that, you know, the stories, but that the family wasn't really frightened. It wasn't like Hollywood where, you know, blood's dripping out of the walls. It was just, yeah, someone else lives here with us. What are you going to do? And so
wow.
I went to school to be a journalist, to be a writer. And around October, believe it or not, the media goes looking for these kind of ghostly stories.
I'm shocked.
I know. I can't believe I'm the one to break it here and now. But so around October, and I was no different, we'd go looking for haunted places, and I just got hooked on researching the history, but more than that, interviewing the individual witnesses who've been gripped and moved by what they experienced. And I just knew for certain these people perceived it as real. I can't promise you that there's life after death, but I can promise you that millions of people the world over perceive ghosts as real.
Now, you can argue which came first, the holiday or our need for the holidays, I should say, Day of the Dead, All Souls Day, Halloween. But are we just more likely to look for evidence of the beyond at this time of year?
Well, if you want to believe our Celtic ancestors, they believed that this holiday that they called Samhain was actually the day where the veil between the world of the living and the world of the dead was at its thinnest. And so they believe that that's when the dead could actually come and meddle in our affairs, and they'd throw these wonderful festivals and leave out food offerings and things like that to appease these spirits. So maybe there's a cart and a horse, and I don't know who's in the lead right now, but I do know that you're right. And what used to be, gosh, I remember growing up as a kid, Halloween, you know, you talked about it for about a week ahead of time, and now I think we get the whole month, maybe even more. It's just growing and growing because of our infatuation with all things ghostly, all things haunted. We get to be someone else for that night. It's a great holiday on so many levels, and we get to talk about this touchy subject, and it's a way to talk about death, a way to talk about history, a way to talk about spirituality without getting too many cackles up.
Of the places in the new edition of the Encyclopedia, what is the most unusual one?
Oh, my gosh, most unusual. You know, like I said before, we we found so many different kinds of locations that could be haunted. Old factories, museums, bed and breakfasts, battlefields, rivers, pizza restaurants, you know, I mean, there seems to be to no end, and reasons for the haunting, you know, I mean, sometimes you think, well, tragic murder and the ghost lingers around looking for eternal vengeance or whatever. Sometimes we found that people just seem to want to hang around where they lived. They enjoyed it there, and they don't want to leave, or they don't know they're dead, or for any number of reasons. But, boy, most unusual, you know, you take places like, I think, would have to, if we had to give a prize, maybe the Mummy Museum in Mexico, which is such a great story. When you were buried in this this town in Mexico, you paid an annual tariff. Your family did, rather. Obviously, you didn't if you're dead.
Sure.
But the family paid a tariff, and if they couldn't afford it or chose not to pay it, the body was dug up and put on display where people could pay a few coins to tour and visit. They found that the dry desert air actually had a mummifying process, and even today you can still go see over 100 corpses that were exhumed from the local cemetery.
Charming. I'm not sure I'd want to have that faith, but, you know, everybody's taste is a little different.
When in Rome, you know,
exactly.
Don't judge.
Exactly. Now, you're way too young to have seen James Dean's movies in the theater, but I'm guessing you've seen one or all three on video at some point.
Of course.
And James Dean's home in this tiny farm town of East Fairmount, Indiana, the gravesite is haunted.
That's what they tell us. My theory on that is pretty simple. We love celebrity in this country, in the world, but especially in this country. And I think part of it has to do with people want him still around. People need his essence, his spirit. So do his many fans come there and keep him bound? Or do we invent him and project him even though he's long gone? I don't know, but there's all kinds of offerings left around that gravesite. People leave cigarettes. People leave there's lipstick kisses on the headstone.
Aww.
From some of his many female admirers. But we did hear from one person who said that, you know, he was there completely alone and is a non-smoker and would smell cigarette smoke around the grave, even though no one was there. It was just him. So kind of interesting. Maybe old James Dean is still lingering because
we need him.
We need him. We need him. We don't want to give up on him just yet.
Yeah. So what are some of the other places that you found out about in Indiana?
Well, God, there's so many and so many different paths through history, like the Seven Pillars, which is on the old Francis Slocum Trail, kind of near Peru, Indiana. And this was a place where tribal councils would meet, and it was almost like grotto-like alcoves and really, you know, kind of a beautiful place. Also a campsite today. But it's interesting that it's haunted, and one of the many functions of ghostly legends is that we must remember the past, because if it's haunted, you have to ask why, and if you ask why, you have to go back in history and learn what took place here. Well, these tribal councils were also sometimes criminal proceedings. If someone did wrong within the tribe, that's where you went, and if you were found guilty, you could be beheaded.
Yeah.
So there's an essence left over from Native American days that are still there, and some of the campers seem to be picking up on that, hearing voices, seeing strange lights that they can't explain, a mist that looked to be in the shape of a man swirling around the pillars. These are all things that have been reported in that area.
Did the House of Blue Lights make it onto your radar?
You know, it's not in this book, but let me quote from the introduction. You know, warning: this book is not complete, and it never will be. That's the nature of this thing. You know, we were trying to not only be diverse in the types of locations, but be fair to all the states, all the countries. And so the good news is it's job security, right? We can do the next edition and 10 and 20 more after that, and we still won't get them all. But on the other hand, it's funny how people I've gotten so many emails since the first one came out. I've gotten so many emails from people that just said, I can't believe you left this place out or that place out.
Well, how are you supposed to know about all of them?
Well, I mean, that's my job. And some of them I did know and was very conscious and said, yeah, you know, geez, it didn't make the cut for whatever reason. But what was it more interesting to me is that how personal some people took it, you know. This is like a family friend to some folks. I can't believe you left out, you know, the Waverly Hills Sanatorium in Louisville, Kentucky, which was corrected. We did include that one in the second one. But these places that people feel such a connection to that they seemed somewhat offended that we didn't include it.
But which kind of reinforces the idea that we do need some of these We need some of these places. We need some of these. We need these stories, I guess.
Of course we do. Of course it's folklore. Folklore is still alive and well, even though we've got radio and internet and blogs and 24/7 news coverage. It's still a sharing of story, a telling of tales, and it's a way to discuss our past. It's a connection to our present, and like I said earlier, a way to explore our own inevitable future, because we're all going to die. It's horrible news that we hate to break right here on the radio, but it's true. And by talking about ghosts, we can almost leave religion and all those dogmas out of the discussion for a few minutes, and just say, hey, something happens. People are reporting these events. They perceive them as real. They have some kind of tie to history, and I just don't think all these folks are lying.
And whatever your belief system, you can layer it on top of that.
Exactly. You can run with it from there. I don't have a clue, so I take no claims to be a spiritual guru. I can just tell you about history and what people are perceiving as real all over the world from all walks of life.
And what is your personal Falun tradition? What do you do?
This year is a little bit different because I'm actually going to be part of the 7-hour live ghost investigation on the Travel Channel for the Ghost Adventure Show.
All right.
So we'll be there on Friday, October 30th from 8 p.m. to 3 a.m. With Ghost Adventures at the West Virginia Lunatic Asylum in Weston. And that should be exciting. And so I'm going to get home pretty tired. And I think this year I'm going to have to just take my daughter trick-or-treating.
She's how old?
She's 2.5.
All right. A little bit young to get into all this. Have you ever been scared on any of your expeditions?
Tons of times, but usually of the living. Not so much the dead. I've never been hurt by the dead. But, boy, when you've got, living people out there, some people get foolish, some people get frightened and neurotic, and some people are confused. But for the most part, and I've been in creepy places, catacombs, cemeteries, battlefields, old castles, late at night, early in the morning, you name it. And I just think it's a wonderful way to explore our planet. It's off the beaten path. There are generally no tourist shops in the kind of places I go.
I hope.
You can't buy T-shirts. There's something pure about that.
Well, happy, I don't know whether to say happy haunting or happy hunting.
Yes, well, both, a little of both.
Sharon Gamble with Jeff Bellinger, editor and compiler of the Encyclopedia of Haunted Places. In addition to the Indiana sites you just heard about, the book lists venues around the world. The encyclopedia is available at Barnes & Noble, Borders, Amazon, and many other booksellers. And, of course, you can find out more about it at newpagebooks.com. Again, newpagebooks.com.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4. I'll find out what's going on this season at Beef and Boards.
I'll meet the local author of the new novel, Short Girls.
And I'll find out more about Indianapolis's One Book, One City selection, the Nero Wolf mystery, Some Buried Caesar. And, of course, we'll have our calendar of events we call What'll We Do?
So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter is made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and by grants from the Arts Council of Indianapolis and from the City of Indianapolis and by support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.